Hi folks, how are you? I hope this finds you well. You join me. I'm sat on the floor in a screening room at Soho Hotel in the middle of London on day two of London Film Festival. I'm just about to go and watch Bradley Cooper's new film, Is This Thing On? And so I've popped into the studio next door just to record this for you before I go into the screening. Lots of interviews happening today. I'm off to chat to Yorgos Lanthimos about his new film Begonia and also Edward Berger. It's like Christmas. It's amazing. And with that, we are really spoiling you on soundtracking at the minute with bonus episodes after bonus episode. Our latest is a bit of a legend to Stephen Knight, writer of Peaky Blinders, the next James Bond film, and House of Guinness, which is streaming on Netflix now. Got a fabulous ensemble cast. And it tells the story of the famed brewing company as it becomes established in Ireland and New York. So really the story of these kids, their dad dies and how they kind of inherit, well, some of them inherit the business, but also everything that comes with it. But trying to see how they, what the future holds for the company. It's really fascinating. It's really driven by this young cast that I think are phenomenal and well worth checking out. Before we get to Stephen, I wanted to share a clip from our next episode with Joachim Ronning and Jared Leto, who'll be discussing the new Tron movie, Tron 80s, which is actually out in cinemas today, the 10th of October. Here, Joachim explains why Trent and Atticus were right for the music, but under their Nine Inch Nails banner.
The music in particular is such a big part of the Tron, you know, DNA. So I think it's the question that I've gotten the most over the last 3 years where when I've been involved, when I'm talking to people, everybody wants to know who's making the music. And I never had that experience with any other movie before. So that's where it came. I mean, we talked about it like from the very first moment, and we didn't really put a list together. We basically just had, you know, a name on the, or two names on that list, that, which was Trent and Atticus, and that's what we first were thinking, that that would be amazing if they could come on board. You know, I think that their body of work and catalog really, you know, lends itself to this franchise. So we thought that, okay, that could be a kind of a safe bet in some way. And then I think it was Tom McDougall, actually, over at Disney, head of Disney Music, that we started talking about, should we ask them to do it as Nine Inch Nails?
Yeah.
So that process started, and we got very excited for the prospect of that. And they said yes. And then I felt, okay, now we have something here. Now we can, you know, because Wendy Carlos in the first film, and obviously Daft Punk, you know, they left some very, very big shoes to fill. But I felt when we learned that they would do it under their Nine Inch Nails banner, it changed for me.
Joachim Ronning and Jared Leto in an episode we'll be sharing with you on Monday. And so to Stephen Knight and House of Guinness, which is scored by friend of the show, Ilan Eshkere. And we'll begin with his title cue. To you about your creativity, because music is seeped in it. We've had that conversation before. You're such a big fan. Before we get into music, families. You love telling family stories. They are they just the gift, you know, in terms of the dynamics that
I think so.
Up?
Yeah, I mean, I find
I write what I want to write, and then other people notice that there's a pattern, and it's absolutely true. And the family pattern is definitely there. And I think it's that, well, we all know a family is a group of people who are not necessarily like each other or even are similar to each other, who mm-hmm. are, just by virtue of the fact they're a family, are thrown together. So there's drama straight away. Somebody was saying today that you can all be brought up in the same house and have a totally different upbringing, you know, because it depends who the individual is. So I think families always lead to drama, but this particular family, the Guinness family, you know, add in the biggest brewery in the world and money and wealth and all of those things, and a sort of something in the DNA of that family that draws them to rebellion and to doing strange things and making mistakes. And, you know, when I read the actual history of the Guinness family, it was, I just thought, I better do this quickly before somebody else does.
It's mine.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's fantastic. I'm on episode 7, and it's just, it's like you just want to gorge on it because it's so great. So much going on as well, like you talk about. It's not just the kind of intricate nature of these relationships and these individuals. It's almost everything on the exterior as well, you know, the kind of the politics that's going on as well. That's so fascinating. And where the world was at that time, what was the thing that interested you to jump into that history, to kind of, to want to write it?
It was, I mean, the whole history of the family is so fascinating because all the way through, all the way almost to the present day, the Guinness family have, there's these two things going on. On the one hand, they want to be a respectable aristocracy, because they've come from trade, they come from beer, and so they're trying to sort of overcome that barrier. And at the same time, sometimes on the same day, they will make a decision that's sort of mad and wild. There's something wild about the whole thing that draws them away towards artists and renegades and rebels. And when they make these mistakes, that's when the fires start. And it's so interesting to see that. So that's what actually drew me to this. And then to find a moment in 1868 when it was absolutely crystallised, when a will is read and the four children of Benjamin Guinness are left money, houses, castles, a brewery, and the will manages to make all of them unhappy. But what it does, it sets all four of them off on the trajectory that, you know, is ahead of them, and they then have to choose to do what they are expected to do or not, or both.
That's the thing, is kind of, I love how with each episode, it's like, I might get the wording wrong, but this piece of fiction is based on real events and stuff. And that's the thing, that you have these kind of, these truths to, to kind of almost foundations of things, and then you can you can create in amongst that.
Well, it's stepping stones. I always see it as stepping stones of actual events.
Yeah.
You get the character, you try and find out who that character was, and then you settle upon what that character is. And then you have the stepping stone. So you think, how did that person go from there to making that decision, which was so weird, to there to making the decision that was so clever? You know, and so you try and navigate between the stepping stones of reality.
One of the many things that I love about it as well is it's a really young, you know, the main cast is a really young cast. And I love that about it. I love that it's all this kind of, there's a few of them that we've seen in things and stuff, but it's just a really exciting part of the show, I think, that you've got this really vibrant young cast there.
Well, I mean, the fact is that the real people, Edward and Arthur Guinness and Anne and Benjamin, were all young, like in their early 20s.
Yeah.
So, you know, my kids are in their early 20s. And I imagine, how would they feel to get this thing put onto their shoulders, which is this massive brewery and all this responsibility and all these people who work for them and the philanthropy? How do you do that? And so we wanted that to be reflected in the cast. And, you know, we got first choice said yes in every case.
You're the creator of the show, you're a producer on the show. Are you involved in all of it? Is it important for you to kind of see it through? It's not just a case of kind of writing it, creating it, and then it's collaboration, I know, as well, with the directors and other heads of departments. But
yeah, it's very important to let people do what they do and get the best people and let them get on with it. My bit comes to, you know, at the end when it's all been narrowed down and it's almost like, you know, they're humouring me, I think, you know, look at this one. This one's really good. What do you think? You're going to say yes? But it's no hardship in a case like this, because it was when there was a choice for some of the leading characters, they were all good choices. But in every case, you know, what you're looking for is, because in your head, you know what that character is. You know how they act and what their rhythm is like. And when you see someone, you go, probably 30 seconds in, you go, that's it. That's the one. And then after that, there's probably no going back.
Yeah. Music's always been something, though, that you're really passionate about in you know, in how you write and the shows and the films that you write as well. What was the kind of thought process around this, and how much did you write into the script? Because it's got the music, there's such a variety and it does so many brilliant things. It's really, Elan's done a great job with the score.
Absolutely.
But I think all those other kind of needle drop moments are just are great. They're, and so varied.
They're brilliant. I mean, the choices for the needle drops in particular are done by people much cooler and connected than me.
Come on, I know you've got good taste.
But I do sort of try to establish the ethos of where we are. So it was energy, young, rebellious, not even young necessarily, but energy and fire and also Irish, because for obvious reasons. So fortunately, we have this whole generation of brilliant musicians, singers, bands who are coming out of Ireland, who are doing this stuff that absolutely fits with the mood and the energy of this show. I mean, I do occasionally write in what I think it should be, but often it's just like describing what the music should sound like, and then the choices, I think, in this case have been exceptionally good.
Well, I think it's really nice of doing that thing, of you say, of kind of there being a kind of cultural kind of like collaboration in a way with the music, in terms of whether it be contemporary artists, and then you have those moments of tradition in there as well, and mixing that up.
Yeah, yeah. I think the great thing about music, I think perhaps more so now than for a while, is that people are not afraid to mix the genres. You remember when it used to be very tribal, you know?
Yeah.
And if you liked this sort of music, you hated that sort of music.
Yeah.
And you couldn't go back 10 years because that was ancient history. You know, it was like, and now I think there's much more, and maybe it's what one of the few benefits of the internet that people, I think it's true, people are now just finding music that in other circumstances they would never have ever come across.
It's about
connection. Deciding they love it. And so I think that means that you can mix contemporary folk, heavy metal, whatever.
Yeah.
And as long as the mood is right, then it will work.
Well, I think as well, like Peaky was definitely one of those, the first of those TV shows that kicked back against that the expectation of music around period.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of turning that on its head and stuff. It was really at the forefront of that, I think.
Yeah, there was a lot of comment. I mean, it seems weird now, but there was a lot of comment in the first series when I, you know, what on earth is this? Why are they doing this? But it felt very natural, and I think now it's the norm, I think.
Yeah. What about Elan, you know, in terms of as a composer, and what you were looking for to kind of paint that musical kind of landscape across the show?
It's when you get somebody really good like that, they get the pace and the rhythm of it. I think sometimes the dialogue, I try and give it a rhythm, try and make it have a bit like poetry, so it's got a beat to it. And then when the composer gets that and also drives it on to the next level and to the next stage. And so it's like every now and again, you've got to take a breath, but not very often. You've got to keep it going.
Yeah.
And when they know when to take the big breath and to stop it and slow it down, and then when to go bang back into it, you can really feel it. It's always best when you don't notice it. You feel as if it's just there. It's just natural.
Yeah.
That's what I think happens here.
Incredible when you think about how many things he's writing for musically, you know, kind of all those characters and what they're going through. Yeah. And, you know, like Arthur, for example, you know, in terms of very much kind of paints himself as one thing, but, you know, he's wearing a mask and he's not able to be him true self. But and the music reflects that. It's like a companion to the character's narrative almost in a
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are moments when it's funny as well. And where what I've always felt about the Guinness family in history and in this series is they're all aware of their own absurdity. They're aware of how bizarre this whole thing is. And especially Arthur will sometimes laugh at himself and his pretensions and all of this stuff. And sometimes the music can go there. It can go with that. It can go with Potter, you know, the way he, you know, Potter being the butler. And so it's just like another level. I think music is cheating, actually. It gives you the emotion directly without having to do any work.
I love that scene with Potter where it's the aftermath of the wedding and he just, it's just, but like you say, the tone of it's really great as well. There's like, is that something that, do you go in with an intention of a tone, or is it whilst you're writing that it starts to kind of, you get a sense of what it needs?
It's very difficult. I tend not to know what I'm doing, basically. I tend not to know what I'm going to do, rather.
Yeah.
When I sit down to do it and just start writing.
Yeah.
When the characters come, which usually is quite quick. So you say you've got the characters and you know what they're like and what they're, flaws are and what they're good at and stuff, and then you put them in a room, you can sort of let them get on with it in a way, and then you read it back and you go, oh right, okay, so that's what's going on. So I tend to give authority to what happened most recently in terms of the script. So somebody says something in a scene that contradicts stuff that had gone before, then consider the idea that that's true, and the stuff before you're gonna have to change. You're gonna have to reverse engineer it to fit that. So yeah, it's a very, for me, it's a very odd. It's a bit like music for me. It's a bit like playing. And it's like, it's a bit, well, I've said this before, it's like dreaming, where you just switch everything else off and then it all comes, and then have a look, see what happens.
At your magic fingers in the computer.
Yeah.
Are you on set? Were you on set for this a lot? Or
not a lot, no. I mean, I do visits. I always think either you've got to be there every day.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you turn up like Prince Charles and wondering, so what do you do then? You know, and they go, I'm the director. Go, all right. So, yeah, no, but I went to the fun bits, you know, where the great big scenes and the big sets, and to the brewery, which was built in Stanley Dock in Liverpool. Man, that set.
Was it?
Oh, wow. God, it was so beautiful, so big. And you just think, I don't want this to ever be taken down. It's so good. But, yeah, I mean, you know, it's the director who's there in the mud and the bullets every day doing that work. But I think Stephen Frears said, get the best people and let them get on with it.
Yeah. How important is that for you when you do turn up and you see the kind of, you know, the effort and the creativity that's gone to create the worlds that you've written? You know, it's there. You can touch it. It feels real. It is real. Yeah.
It's when you see the care and attention that's put into things that the person who did it sort of knows will never make it to the screen, but they do it anyway.
Yeah.
Because it's world creation. And so it, obviously the instruction is wherever, if we decide to turn the camera that way, there's got to be something there that is right.
Yeah.
But sometimes that it's a place where the camera's never going to go, but people do it anyway. And it's the commitment of the crew. You can, when you go, that's one good thing about going to the set, is you get the feeling of the crew, from the crew and from the set, about what is the mood of this place. You know, is it a happy set? Is it not? And this, I mean, I'm promoting this, so I would say this, but I'm not joking. I mean, this group of people who are portraying a family began to behave very much like a family, which is good and bad. but there's that, you know, commitment. There's that shared goal.
Yeah, and also outside of those kind of, you know, like the brewery and stuff, there's that, those beautiful houses and the kind of rural parts of Ireland that we see there as well. There's that wonderful scene where Edward's kind of getting the water out the river to test the water and stuff, and stumbling all over the place. And it's just really lovely to see the kind of, you know, the landscape of. And it's because it's part of the storytelling, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's trying to tell the whole story of the Guinness family, which is they did live in these massive, great big mansions and castles. But they sort of did something which is very, very unfashionable now, which is give some of it away to people who deserved it. And, you know, in London now, there are still fantastically built buildings, which they built, which were built to house the poor of London and the poor of Dublin. And so they did get out there, partly recreational, but what I've tried to reflect is that when they went out into the country in Ireland and saw, you know, that was it's a brutal place, rural Ireland, as well as being beautiful and glorious. It's then was a very brutal place. And, you know, we're only 20 years after the famine.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to reflect the fact through the eyes of the family that they got it. They understood that actually there's something going on. We should do something about
it. Yeah. Was it easy to know, or how did you work out where to, you know, end this particular series? I'm very much hoping there's going to be more.
Yes.
But knowing kind of
Is that always a hard decision, or is that, I mean, have you got it's start and end, and then you, it's kind of filling in the middle bit? Or
again, it's a funny thing, because I just set off, as I say, with a vague idea of where I'm heading.
Yeah.
Not always getting there, but if you know the destination, that helps in terms of time and events and stuff. And I was looking at the actual events and seeing where it'd be nice to get to. And as usual, you set off thinking, I'm going to cover 10 years here. And you cover 10 months, you know, because you get into it so much, you don't want to jump.
Yeah.
I find it difficult to time jump. And if there's a time jump between series, I think is the way to do it. So, yeah, I sort of had an idea that it would be a political moment at the end because of Arthur's political career and his absurd attempt to rig an election, which is all true, all of those mad things that he does to rig an election with train tickets and a wardrobe with a hole cut in the back and people handing each other pound notes. That's all true. I didn't make that. Oh, how would I make that up? It's too
wild.
So he does all that, and then, you know, we end it when he's on the road to political stability.
See, that's the thing that people like almost kind of the real stuff is almost the stuff always, you can't believe is real.
Always maddest, yeah. always.
What was the weirdest or the maddest thing that you discovered about the family from your research on this then? Is it in the show or is it
many things. I mean the you know, this is spoiler free, I'm assuming.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Not spoiler free, we're okay.
Yeah, we're okay to talk. Yeah, totally.
The fact of Arthur's, you know, he's the head of, he's left, he's the senior member of the family after Benjamin's death. And he's gay. And at that time, if you wanted to be a Conservative MP or if you wanted to stay at Liberty, you didn't admit that you were gay. So they have to put up this front. So he has to marry. And it was a very regular occasion, event when someone would have a marriage blanche where they would have a marriage for respectability and for show, but there would be an agreement that there was no obligation from anybody's part to have sex with each other.
Yeah,
but they were both free to have sex with other people
if they wanted. Yeah,
and then the negotiation about, well, who can we trust? Who's not going to tell the servants? Who's not going to go to the papers? So, but everybody knows about it, and so the whole family know about it. Absolutely fine, but they all know that this is a marriage blanche.
Yeah,
so stuff like that is just a gift. Because you've got that triangle of characters that you've already got to know. So all of that. The election rigging is beyond belief, that however they thought they were going to get away with that. And they get caught, of course. But throughout, I think what's great about the Guinness family as individuals, they do pretty bonkers things sometimes. Yeah. It's the opposite to their attempt to become respectable.
Makes for better telling.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank goodness they are.
Knowing your kind of appreciation of music and how important it can be in storytelling, have you got favourite soundtracks that you've enjoyed over the years?
From other shows, you mean? I mean, it's...
Films or shows,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's classics, I suppose. You know, I think what always works is when the soundtrack, you sort of go, what on earth? You know, I'm thinking Good, the Bad and the Ugly. When that happened, it was mad. The maddest one is The Shining.
Yeah.
Where it's as if somebody's been given freedom to do it when they don't know what they're doing, or the volume switch is not quite right. And it's brilliant because in moments of not necessarily great drama, the music goes mad and you're like, what's going on? What am I missing? And so I think that those are the moments when the soundtrack makes itself known.
Yeah.
Where normally, I mean, I always think it's the weirdest thing is that you watch a film and everybody has paid huge amounts of attention to detail. Every single piece of equipment is actually there and it's all right. Mm-hmm. And there's this orchestra. And nobody ever says, well, where's the orchestra? Yeah. Where's that music coming from? Yeah. It's such a convention that we all get that we don't question it anymore. I mean, thank goodness we do.
I remember taking my youngest to see Star Wars playback at the Royal Albert Hall.
Oh, yeah.
And the first thing he said when we came out was like, they play through the whole film. And it's like...
Yeah, why don't they stop?
But yes, like you really don't appreciate it while you're just enjoying it. And to see those players play non-stop, you're like, wow, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I wanted to just talk briefly about Maria as well, because I just thought that was a gorgeous film. And just a really tender and really emotional insight into Tamiria Kallas, and wanted to sort of talk a little bit about diving into her world, you know, to write that script.
Yeah, that was a great privilege, really. And Pablo, I love working with
director.
Pablo, he's really good. And again, just doing the research into that and finding the madness of her life, the last week of her life when she's with her servants who are no longer servants, their family.
I love those and two. I want a spin off of those two, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good idea. But the soundtrack for that obviously was determined by the music. Mm. And you know, Pablo was brought up with opera. And so we discussed that, you know, how the mood would be and tried where possible to. It's when Maria's life really imitates the lives of central female characters in opera, which it did, strangely. And her life, you know, the tragedy and the love affair and all of that.
She was so young when she died.
She was young when she did everything, and that was the thing. But she had this voice, and then the problem was she didn't like herself, how she looked. And she had this gift, amazing gift of a voice. When she lost weight, it went away. Mm. And when she put on weight, it came back. So she's trying to choose, what am I going to do, you know, and being told by lots of men to lose the voice. It's just a tragedy, but also, again, I hope if you watch the film, it's funny as well. She had fun. She was a laugh. And again, aware of her own absurdity, said great things in interviews.
And those sets as well, and the costumes and the production, and that was just magnificent.
Beautiful.
So you felt it, you know, you felt those fabrics and you could kind of smell those apartments and stuff. It was amazing.
But it's that thing about opera. I mean, it's like...
Are you a fan of opera?
I am now. I mean, I was when I was about 12, weirdly, because, I don't know, I lived in a house with lots of brothers and sisters, and one particular brother used to bring loads of records in from everywhere.
Yeah.
He just virtually bought them by weight.
Yeah.
And then just brought them in. So it could be anything. And one of them was Madame Butterfly.
Oh, wow.
And I remember listening to that and thinking, wow, this is amazing. It's just that, is that the noise that human beings make? You know, like a bird sings. Is that what human beings can do when they do that full thing? Is amazing.
I know there's a couple of exciting things on the horizon as well, which I'm not going to ask you about because I hope I get a chance to talk to you about them at length near the time. But in preparation for one of them, have you got a favourite Bond song?
Song?
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to answer any questions about Bond.
Don't worry about it. It's fine. No, I thought that was a roundabout way of getting excited about it. I want to ask, I saw two things quickly. Taboo. Are we ever going to get more Taboo?
God, we're trying. Me and Tom are trying to get
that. I love that show.
I know. Everybody does. Whenever I do American press, at the end of it, they turn off the thing and go, are you going to do any more Taboo? So we both want to do it. We both know what we want to do. We got the story. It's just a question of getting the time. We will do it, definitely. And it's going to be really good. I mean, the story's really good we're going to do.
I can't wait. I love that show so much. And then Locke has kind of grown arms and legs and become this, like, unbelievable international kind of... It's like a musical. It's been translated into, like, every... How incredible... I mean, it was a great film. I remember talking to you about it. At London Film Festival, like years ago, about it. Has that just been something over the years that it's been kind of building and building, or has it always had that kind of, did it have that instant?
It had an instant effect in the areas where people saw it. And I remember doing the US tour for that, and you'd go to like Midwestern towns, and a middle aged man afterwards, who'd probably been dragged there, his wife had said, I'm going to watch Tom Hardy in a car. An hour off, and you go, oh, really? But afterwards, come up quite emotional, saying, that's the journey my dad never made. And he's the kid, you know, he's the kid that was born. So I knew there was something there. But yeah, it's one of those things. These things are like a tick-tock, and they just sort of grow. I mean, Peaky did it, but quite quickly. But with Locke, it's one of those things that sometimes, I just now somebody said, do you ever direct anything? I said, I did Locke. Oh, my. But they do love it, you know. And I'd love to, I want to put it on stage.
Oh, great.
And I'm going to do that at some point. When I get some time, I'm going to put it on stage.
Get Tom to do it as well.
No, this is the thing.
That'd be good, wouldn't it?
I know.
He'd do it.
Well, think of doing it for charity, you know what I mean? Just doing a 2-week run and then putting various people in.
Because
you can cheat, you can do it on autocue.
There we go. I'm there. I'll see you for Bond and Peaky, and thank you for your chats today.
No,
lovely chat,
Stephen,
as always. Thank you.
From the score to House of Guinness, that's Spit Ink rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Stephen Knight. My huge thanks to Stephen for taking the time to talk to us. House of Guinness is streaming now and is yet another example why he is regarded as one of our finest screenwriters. You can catch up with every single episode of Soundtrackin' at edithbowman.com, where you can also remind yourself of our email address, which is info@edithbowman.com. We'd love to hear from you. Follow us on your socials. We're at Soundtrackin' UK. Please do subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is Soundtrackin' Extra, for loads of bonus content, including a couple of people behind this new great little film called Lurker. It's been created by one of the people behind The Beef and the Bear. It's well worth checking out. Next up, though, as I mentioned, it's Joachim Ronning and Jared Leto who join us to discuss Tron Ares. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.